down.
Roger, roger. And you should be able to see the buildings and stuff like that just as the board makes the bend in the river there. Looks like.
We're picking up some ground fire down there, it looks like. I'm going to have to change my running heading. I'll still turn left here and keep clear of you.
When we were a surgical hospital, of course, all the nurses worked in the emergency room or the recovery room unless you were an OR nurse, and I was not an OR nurse. So I worked in the emergency room, and it was just a humongously big room that was like the size of a aircraft hangar that had sawhorses all over the room. And, of course, the sawhorses were there to accept the litters that were coming in off the choppers. And in hanging from the ceiling all along by those sawhorses were these wire hooks. And the wire hooks were there for the IVs, to hang the IVs on when the troops were being brought in. On a quiet day when there were no casualties, it was just a matter of the room being there with the wind blowing through and blowing those iron hooks around and those empty sawhorses being there waiting for the next patient, and then all of a sudden the radio.
This is Raider Alpha 6. I have an urgent dust-off mission. Coordinates.
I hear the radio. It's dust-off. Dust-off is calling our hospital and telling us where they are, how many casualties they got, what kind they are, and how far away they are, what their, you know, ETA 4 minutes or whatever, and what kind of injuries they have, so we know what to get the doctor, the triage officer, ready. And our hospital was on a bluff about 85 feet high, overlooking the South China Sea, and the helipad was right outside the door to the emergency room, so that when the helicopters started coming in, the wind, of course, from the propellers just blew right through the emergency room. And you could hear them. To this day, I can hear a Huey. I mean, it's a very distinct sound, and that's what the dust-off pilots used. And I must say I give all the credit in the world. My heroes of Vietnam are the combat medics and the dust-off pilots, because they saved so many lives just by putting a chopper down in a place where no one thought they could ever put a chopper, and getting those victims on that chopper and getting them to the hospitals as quickly as they did.
I loved aviation, I guess, since I was a little kid. For some reason, I knew that I had a fascination with flying machines, and I really never planned on flying helicopters. I wanted to be a fighter pilot and join us. I was in uniform most of my life, Cub Scouts, Boy Scouts, Civil Air Patrol, ROTC at the University of Connecticut. For some reason, I felt comfortable there. But I always had a fascination for aircraft, and I always knew I wanted to fly. And as I got older, it got to the point I didn't care who I flew for. As long as I was a military aviator, that's what I wanted. And the Army afforded me the chance to go from high school to flight school. And I had planned, again, to possibly apply for naval aviation, but I was like a semester short. And I looked into the Army, and it looked good. And there was a war going on, which I wasn't particularly interested in getting into, but again, a military aviator would like to know what he wants, what he would do under fire. And it's not the greatest place to be. I don't recommend it, but I guess that's part of like being a professional athlete or a football player or whatever. You have to get into the big game to know what you're going to do. So, but aviation was always a love of mine, still is.
I was not the military type as far as any of that training goes. I just was hoping, you know, that maybe medical, you know, I get into the medic part, I'll be all right in that. But I was a kind of sad sack type guy with my weapon upside down, and that's one picture I should have brought. You know, and that kind of stuff. I was just kind of booting along and that, and I got through the basic. Now, once I got through the basic, then I went on down to San Antonio, Texas, into the medical field. And the Vietnam thing, I was confused. I really didn't know what was going on. I wasn't all that upset about if I was going to go, because I found out as soon as we got down here at Fort Sam Houston, the majority of medics that were going to go We're going to go to Vietnam. Your class, you know, your whole class was just about going to go because there was such a turnover of medics. You were trained a little different, though. It must have been very naive, and I was already 22 years old, but naive because they made it sound like, well, you'll get over there, and if you don't get into a hospital, you'll be hooked up with a combat unit, but you'll kind of go out to the war, and then you'll come back, and you'll be back for a while, you know, like you got your wall locker and all this kind of stuff and that. So I kind of thought, well, this won't be too bad, I didn't think. Well, it was totally different once I got off that plane. Very different. At first, you didn't know you were going to combat yet. You know, you're still a medic. You're still thinking you might go to a big hospital or something like that. So the heat hits you, and all these guys are all definitely different than you. You got crisp uniforms, that, and all these guys are waiting and applauding you as you're getting off because they're going home finally. And that reality just didn't hit me yet what was going on. The big hit was there was a lot of paper shuffling and stuff like that for the next 48 hours, and then they lined you up, and then they started saying where you were going. Out of the 38 medics that were with me, they kind of grouped you all together. Two of us goofing off just saying that, well, we know we're going to go to an infantry unit. We were only two that went to an infantry unit. All the others did go to hospitals.
Probably the first month that I was there, I cried every day, all the time. I mean, it was while I was on duty, when I was over in my room at night, or if I was working nights, when I was in my room during the day. Probably the only time I didn't cry is when I was sleeping, because it was just overwhelming. It was absolutely overwhelming. I couldn't have ever been prepared for anything like that. Even though I went through basic training, even though they, at Fort Sam, when we went through basic training, they took us through this exercise called the Vietnam Village. That was just to get us used to the country. They couldn't possibly have prepared us for what we saw and what we were expected to do, and to emotionally be prepared, professionally be prepared, have enough character to survive it. It was just overwhelming.
Basically, we unloaded the aircraft, put them together, test flew them, and again, most of the guys I flew with had been there before. So I'm flying with second tour boys that were very, very good at what they did and showed you how to do things with that UH-1 that was not taught to you in flight school. I remember one captain telling me, he said, you're probably not going to make it out of here alive, but listen to what I have to tell you, and let me show you how to do this, and maybe you'll have a better chance at it. So that was a real sobering speech this guy made before we climbed into the cockpit, and I was all ears and eyes. Basically, yes or no, sir, show me what you have so I can stay alive. And lessons well learned, which you pass on again to somebody else as they come up.
You were popped out of a helicopter, just kind of thrown out air with your bags and that, and you're there. You're out there. You know, you didn't know what anything was about or anything like that. You were the medic. One medic was with each platoon. The next day I went with the mortar platoon. And that first mission, the next day mission, was reality. Going after this, I don't like using the terms, but crispy critters, a couple guys down in a helicopter going out looking for them and stuff like that. And that's when it hit. And then you wondered, what the heck? And like I said, I had some age going for me, but I had one plus being a medic, because right away then you had a job. You know, these kids that were infantrymen and people like that, those poor guys, you know, they had jobs. But, you know, what I could do is I could hide behind my job. I could say, well, I have no idea what this Vietnam thing is, who that poor guy is we're shooting at or anything like that, but I'm here to take care of my men. And I always thank the dear Lord for that. I always thank being a medic. I carried a weapon. I carried a .45 in plastic, you know, so it wouldn't get wet. And I think I only had to take it out one time. And thank God the poor guy that I was taken out to was just as young and scared, and he took off. You know, I was always very, very happy that I was a medic.
At the time, I think I was the most afraid was when the action was over with, is when they we were coming out of Ben Tre at about 800 feet in the Delta. It was the second lift of the day, and we got hit pretty bad with automatic weapons fire, and the kid flying next to me I thought was killed. He the bullets came through the cockpit, and I thought they went underneath his chicken plate. And he slumped over on the controls, and I was flying the aircraft. Well, I didn't even know this guy very well. In fact, the day earlier that day, we talked about who was a magnet ass, me or him. And he said, well, neither. I mean, I've been hit, but not that many times. And the second lift of the day, we get hit. We get chopped up really bad. Little did I know I had battle damage in the tail rotor section. Well, I had another ship come up, and I said I was hit. And another ship come up, looked me over, and I wasn't leaking any fluid, so I looked down and said everything was in the green, and we went to the hospital area, and there was already a helicopter on the pad, and I chose not to land there. There was two-story buildings all around the helipad there at the hospital, so I decided to land over a ditch, and of course, this kid still slumped over the controls, and there was nobody on board but me and the crew, and we got down to bottom, and I don't know whether what snapped back there, but I lost my tail rotor. I don't know whether I lost the shaft or the control. I had no idea. There was no way of knowing. And she started to spin out of the control. Well, I couldn't hover. I couldn't do a hovering out of rotation because I was over a ditch and I was next to the hospital. And if I'd have rolled this thing in a ball, I'd have killed everybody in the hospital. So I opted to go back in the air. And at this time, the airplane's going out of control, going round and round. And I'm trying to learn how to fly a helicopter without the tail rotor controls, and it's quite an interesting experience. And the guy next to me who decides to wake up and get out of controls with me, which is a no-no. And we went round and round, and finally I landed the aircraft, and right there at the hospital area, where I wasn't going to land in the first place, and they took him into the hospital, and I shut the aircraft down and got out and sat down and couldn't get up. I remember a bunch of guys from the area came over and wanted to talk to me. I just could not stand up. They had to help me up. I guess that was the worst I ever physically felt as far as being afraid. And I can't remember how long that was. It might have been 10 minutes. It might have been a half hour. I know I finally obviously did get up, but I was pretty afraid. When it was going on, I just remember saying to myself, I know I'm going to die, but I'm very busy. I remember saying that. And the tower kept screaming, what was the matter? And I didn't have time to talk to him. I had an airplane. It was totally out of control. And you know, it's kind of an instantaneous course on how to fly an aircraft out of control. They didn't cover that in flight school, by the way. I think my first experience with medevac was up in Icor in the mountains, and I've pulled some night medevac in the mountains, and that's hairy. Night mountain flying without much illumination, unless you know the area of operation real well, will get you killed because you're flying around mountains and stuff like that. But we had people that were hit. They had a fire base under a mortar attack, and they scrambled myself and another chief warrant officer, and he'd been there before, although I did most of the flying, and we had to go into a saddle between two artillery batteries where we had to pick up the wounded, and it was dark. We landed to a strobe light. Basically, what they do is they put a little light that would blink, and you land to that. We had a bit of a moon, so I could barely make it out, and we just didn't do that much night flying in the mountains, but this time they were hit real bad. We had to go, and we went. And I remember making the approach, and we turned off all our lights. I think I hit the landing light really quickly just before I touched down to see where I was landing and shut it off. I don't think the mortar attack was up more than a minute, maybe two, before we went in. And I remember sitting there between the saddle waiting for them to bring the wounded down, and we were at full RPM thinking they're going to drop one right down on these plates. I mean, I'm not going to make it out of here. I'm just praying they're not going to hit us again. Knowing they saw the landing light come on and knowing they were reloading the mortar tubes, and I'm thinking, I don't know why I'm doing this for a living, but if I ever get out of this alive, I will go to church every Sunday, and you're making all kinds of pacts with God to see if you can get through this. And all of a sudden, you look up, and here they come running down with the stretchers and the guys with the bottles in them, and you put them on board, and you grab a handful of pitch, and you're out of here thinking, oh, man, how did I get through this one? And come to find out, you do it again the next night. Don't ask me why, but you do. That's because that's why you're an Army pilot.
That was one of my worst ones. I didn't think I'd be able to talk about it, but I guess I can. That was one of my worst ones. I was supposed to get on this aircraft and go in later. And my buddy said, why don't you go get the beer? You go on the first one. And I went on the first one. And then probably what happened, we had a lot of terrible, goofy accidents. We got killed a lot by our own crap. Our own stuff, you know. And I waited about an hour and a half, and my buddy wasn't coming on any of his aircrafts. And finally, me and a priest went down to one of the tents, and we found his body where he got blown up. Those are the things, you know, and you don't know why. you got your friend laying in a tent, you know, this death tent, you know, and you're going by looking, and you got Vietnamese there, the enemy. And they're treating him almost better or something, you know. It's probably all up in here. That was bad. That was rough. I started kicking a few of those, and I'm not a violent person at all. And that's when the chaplain took me. The chaplains are really aces as far as I'm going. And that was my roughest. That was my roughest. Young kid from Alabama that was a conscientious objector, changed his mind. He carried a .45, and I lost him. And he was one of my best buddies. That's the one that went on the aircraft after me. It wasn't easy. But you pop back. You pop back because you got to take care of those others. That's the thing. You had that other. I mean, I don't know what I would have done if I didn't have that job. We were getting battled pretty bad, really, really bad one night. Just soldiers getting killed left and right, and we had helicopters keep coming in. Ghost Rider was the one guy's name. He didn't care. He wasn't a medevac, but he was going to come in and he was going to get my people. And he came in four different times to come in and get my people. And the last time, I was wounded. I didn't know it at the time and that. And he got hit. He got hit, and his other pilot was somewhat, he was all right, but things were shaking up. So I got my people in, and I got into one of the seats, and I helped them. You know, we got the aircraft out, and we got it out. And then once we got back to the base where we were at, I sat on this little ammo can crying, thinking that I'm going to be in trouble, you know, because I was with that aircraft, and I didn't leave my people, but I needed to. This was something I pulled. And then I found out that, well, I was going to be awarded all this stuff and everything. And that the wound was the butt wound. And I tell you, there's nothing, the butt wound just doesn't get you. That's one of those Purple Hearts you don't talk about when you get hit in the butt.
You hear that Huey coming. Whether you're on duty or not, you hear it coming. And the first thing you do is run to the emergency room to see if you're not on duty, to see if they need extra help. Or they, you know, how many casualties do they have coming? And you stand at the door and you watch the chopper land, and the medics run out. Whoever's available runs out to the chopper to start bringing the gurneys in. You see other wounded soldiers that are the walking wounded helping another one of their buddies wanting to carry a litter. They bring them in and they start lining them up, and you just go to the first litter and wait for the triage officer to try to tell you who needs, you know, who's in what category, who needs care, who can... You know, what can we do for whomever? Of course, the worst category was the expectant. And those were the troops that we knew that were going to die no matter what we did for them. And probably the hardest job there was the job of the triage officer. And when a doctor wasn't available to do it, a nurse had to do it. And to make that decision, no matter what we do for this guy, he's going to die. And if we put him over in a litter in the corner and take care of 20 other guys, we can save lives. Rather than taking several hours to take care of one guy that's going to die anyway. And that was the hardest part. That was the part that where you begin to question, you know, what am I here for? What value? What am I doing? If I can't take care of this one person and make a difference, you know, maybe I shouldn't be here. Maybe I can't really make a difference with anybody. That's when you begin to say, I better, you know, I got to get rid of these feelings. I got to stop feeling this way because I got to realize it's, you know, what we can do for the greatest number. And we had in our recovery room, we had an area of the recovery room where we would put the guys that were expectant. And if you were off duty, it was just something you did as the nurse. You would go to that bedside and you would clean the troop up. If he's still in his bloody fatigues or whatever, and wash his face, wash his hands, talk to him, hold his hand, and it just was something that there was no schedule that said, Barb, you know, you're scheduled to go sit with this guy today that's dying. It was just, you know, I might be there for 4 or 5 hours, and then all of a sudden another nurse would show up, and we would just sit there at their bedside and hold their hand, talk to them until they died, just so they wouldn't be alone. And sometimes we were able to find out some personal information, and we could write a letter to their families and say, you know, I was the nurse that was with Joe when he died, and I just wanted to tell you that he died, and peacefully, and I was, he was not alone. And sometimes you get letters back from those parents or that wife or whomever thanking you for that. In most cases, I'd have to say that the soldier that was dying might have known that I was beside him, but he was unable to show me that physically, because his brain was dead or his body was near dead. Occasionally, you might get a responsive grasp in your hand, but it was usually, at the time, it meant a lot if you could feel some kind of reaction. I mean, to be able to see a tear from an eye or something, but that really didn't happen. In most cases, the troop was so far gone that it was impossible. The ones that were very gut-wrenching were the troops that came in on the chopper that were still conscious, that had lost a leg, and they're grabbing you and saying, "Nurse, don't let me die, nurse, don't let me die. You know, nurse, my leg hurts," and they don't have a leg, and it's trying to deal with them was emotionally as gut-wrenching as staying by the bedside of a troop that was dying. People ask me today, how did you survive Vietnam? You know, how did you survive the carnage of every day? Every day was a mass casualty. Every day it was one body after another that had bits and pieces blown apart or major parts missing. And I tell people to this day, the only way I can survive was just to turn myself off. I could no longer get involved with this patient. I couldn't worry about, you know, this is Joe from Iowa on this stretcher. To me, this was just another number, another victim. I couldn't get emotionally involved with my patients the way I'd been trained to do as a nurse. The only way I could be efficient as a nurse was to turn myself off so that I could function and perhaps save a life that I wouldn't normally be able to do if I was standing there thinking about how horrible it was that this was happening to them. So emotion-wise, after a while, I was just numb. I didn't think about who was doing what. I was just thinking about doing my job and getting through each day and surviving.
There's a high-flying bird way up in the sky, and I wonder, does he look down as he flies on by, riding on the air so easy in the sky? But Lord, look at